A note before we begin. Due to the nature of this episode, listener discretion is advised. It includes mentions of kidnapping, murder, and harm against minors. Consider this when deciding how and when you'll listen. For the past 2 years, I've been examining all kinds of missing person cases on this show. Everything from alien abduction theories to murders, trafficking, runaways, spies, accidents, abductions, and government conspiracies. Like I say every week, I set out on this journey to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. More than 100 releases later, I'm proud of what we've done. Most of you know that I started podcasting out of my closet with exactly zero experience. Working with the team on this show has taught me so much about research, writing, and crafting a meaningful story that will get people to care about these cases, which is always the goal. These stories are so much more than just entertainment. We have a real opportunity to help, and I'm forever grateful for my experience with disappearances. Today, I'm talking about three cases that have each, in their own way, impacted my outlook on true crime and changed the landscape of missing person investigations forever. Out of tragedy and darkness came advocacy and reforms, creating silver linings for future generations. The work that I do, the work I feel everyone in the true crime space can do, stands on their shoulders. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is the final episode of Disappearances, a Spotify podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to start with a case that made kidnapping a felony. It's late June 1874 in Germantown, Pennsylvania. Christian Ross's 6-year-old child, Walter, has something to show him. Candy. Walter seems pleased with himself, but Christian's concerned. Where did the candy come from? Walter explains that a man in a wagon gave it to him and his little brother, Charlie. Christian realizes this is a teachable moment and cautions Walter, don't ask strangers for anything. As Walter toddles away, Christian thinks to himself, how nice of these strangers to bring some joy to two little boys. And the incident doesn't cross his mind again. There's a lot on Christian's plate right now. He's been struggling financially since the 1873 stock market crash, and his wife is out of town visiting Atlantic City with their older daughter. He's solo parenting his younger 5 kids with the help of a nanny, cook, and a gardener. So when Christian comes home from work a few days later and can't find Walter or Charlie, there are at least 3 adults to ask. Last anyone saw, the boys were outside, The area between the Ross's house and the neighbor's lot is huge, 3 acres, including a swing. Christian searches all the nooks and crannies, but his boys aren't anywhere to be found. The Ross brothers are only 4 and 6, so they couldn't have gotten far on their own. After scouring the neighborhood, Christian hurries to the Germantown police station. On the way there, he stops suddenly. There's Walter on the road. He's with a stranger who introduces himself as Mr. Peacock. Mr. Peacock says he found Walter in Kensington, over 5 miles away. Apparently, Walter was standing on a street corner, lost and alone. Mr. Peacock worried for him and took it upon himself to get Walter home safely. Walter confirms the story. Mr. Peacock just wanted to help. Christian's relief to have Walter is mixed with deepening fear. Where's Charlie? Walter answers. He's with the men in the wagon. Terrified, Christian sends Walter home and continues to the police station. He informs officers that his 4-year-old son Charlie is missing. The officers blow him off. It's probably just a drunken prank, they say. To them, it's unthinkable that someone in Germantown would have taken a child maliciously. Charlie will turn up. Christian just needs to be patient. And that's about it. In 1873, there's no protocol for kidnapping, no real laws against it. The police don't have a playbook because they haven't really had a reason to write one. Frustrated, Christian stays out all night, searching for Charlie. The next morning, he sits 6-year-old Walter down and asks him to recount exactly what happened. Walter explains that the 2 men who'd given him and Charlie candy came back. As Christian learns, they had actually stopped by the Ross's yard a couple times in the past 2 weeks, but yesterday they said they had an even bigger treat for the boys. Fireworks. Charlie loves fireworks. He'd been counting down the days until the 4th of July, begging his dad to buy him sparklers. So when the men in the wagon said that they'd take Charlie and Walter to go buy fireworks, the boys climbed right in. But the men didn't drive directly to the store. They took a twisty, confusing route. They eventually did arrive at the store, though. They handed Walter the money and sent him inside to buy fireworks alone. When he came back outside, the wagon was gone. With this new information, Christian and Walter retrace the route the men took that day based on Walter's memory. Witnesses they meet along the way confirm Walter's story. They remember seeing the wagon. Christian asks all the neighbors to keep an eye out, updates the police, and publishes a personal ad in the paper. Notably, it doesn't include the family's info or even Charlie's name. Instead, it directs people to contact the police. He doesn't want Charlie's mother to learn he's missing, and Christian's still confident he'll find his son quickly before his wife returns from Atlantic City. Everyone's attitude, or at least their operating hope, is that this will be resolved uneventfully. Until July 4th. Charlie's been missing for 3 days when Christian receives a ransom note. A second one follows soon after, and the notes change everything. They demand that the Rosses send $20,000 to Charlie's kidnappers, or they'll kill him. It's a terrifying reality to grapple with for anyone in any time period. But in 1874, it's absolutely unheard of, because Charlie is the first known American child ever held for ransom. The police up their investigation, but caution Christian not to pay the ransom. They think it might encourage future kidnappings, and that's not something they're prepared for. In 1874, kidnapping isn't a major crime. It's classified as a misdemeanor, with punishments on par to drunken antics, not child endangerment. For the men who took Charlie, it's low risk, high reward. And this leads to a major conflict in Charlie's case. How do you get one child home safely without endangering others? The trolley problem hangs over Christian's head as he finally tells his wife their son is missing. She's devastated. But their pain is only just beginning. Over the next 4 months, the Rosses receive 23 ransom notes. Many are multiple pages, filled with grammatical mistakes, and full of threats to kill Charlie and other children. They toy with the Rosses' emotions, saying Charlie keeps asking if he'll be home in time for a family trip, and they mention details that haven't been circulated to the public, like the fact that Charlie was wearing a pink ribbon around his head that day to keep the hair out of his eyes. The Rosses are positive these letters are from the kidnappers, so they answer them. They follow the abductor's demand to communicate through personal ads in the local newspaper, the Philadelphia Public Ledger. But the Ross's first ad isn't the only mention of Charlie in the ledger. The newspaper is one of many covering the case. Combined with the posters and circulars the Ross's spread across Pennsylvania, Charlie is everywhere, except with his family. By August, the case has taken off in the public consciousness in a way no missing child case has before. As Christian wrote, "In the blink of an eye, children became infinitely more precious because they weren't just someone you loved, but someone you could lose, someone who could be stolen from you." Over the next few months, the Rosses receive a deluge of letters, not just ransom notes, but offers of assistance. At least one person offers to pay the entire ransom. Others send tips, alleged sightings, psychic predictions, even hate mail. But most are eager to help. Maybe too eager. Every child on the street could be little Charlie Ross, and soon it feels like every child on the street is getting reported to the police. And not just in America, some sightings come from as far away as Germany. One Pennsylvania mother is harassed to the point where she requests a certificate stating her son is not in fact Charlie Ross. Christian gives it to her. She's not the only person this happens to. Christian writes that almost 300 children were investigated worldwide, and he estimates that 500,000 people got involved in the search. It's inspiring and overwhelming. Real leads get lost in the slush, and it takes almost 2 months for detectives to narrow in on legitimate suspects, William Mosher and Joseph Douglas. Not only do they own a wagon and match Walter's physical description of the abductors, but officials receive tips that fuel suspicions further and add credibility. One tip claims that Mosher and Douglas had been plotting to kidnap a Vanderbilt for ransom, and another comes from Mosher's own brother. Detectives search for the two suspects for weeks. In an effort to locate the men, police have Christian publish personal ads saying he'll actually pay the ransom. The kidnappers just have to name the time and place. But the response the ad receives is completely unexpected. The kidnappers rescind their offer. The ransom no longer stands. Investigators are at a loss for what to do. And the next time there's a break in the case, it comes from a completely unrelated crime. That December, 5 months after Charlie's abduction, William Mosher and Joseph Douglas break into a house on Long Island. They get caught and shot down. On his deathbed, Douglas confesses. He and Mosher kidnapped Charlie Ross. The police ask where Charlie is. Douglas says he doesn't know. Ask Mosher. But they can't do that. Mosher's already dead. Little 6-year-old Walter IDs the bodies. These are certainly the men who kidnapped him and his brother. It's a hollow victory. The criminals are apprehended, but the search for Charlie continues. The authorities narrow in on a third accomplice, William Westervelt, but he claims innocence and says he's unaware of Charlie's location. Even after Westervelt is found guilty, there's no forward movement. Christian Ross is confident there's another accomplice out there who was watching Charlie the night Douglas and Mosher decided to commit that burglary on Long Island. He dedicates the rest of his life to hunting them down. Christian Ross died before he could be reunited with Charlie, but his efforts still had a major impact. First, the state of Pennsylvania made kidnapping a felony crime in 1875. The legislators were inspired directly by Charlie's story and letters Christian wrote to them. They hoped this punishment would discourage copycat crimes. More recently, Charlie's story caught the attention of Megan Good. In 2004, she founded an internet database of missing persons cold cases. She named it in honor of Charlie Ross, the Charlie Project. It's been a helpful resource for this podcast. The Charlie Project compiles all online information about a missing persons case into one page. It allows the public to see what's been investigated and lists the channels for submitting tips. It helps people who want to help with searches without overwhelming families and investigators with tips. And it revolves around one of the biggest themes of Charlie's story. People want to help find the missing. They just don't always know how.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
On a strangely warm Saturday in January 1996, Amber Hagerman heads on over to her grandparents' house in Arlington, Texas. She doesn't live far away, and she's been leaving her bike at their place. Shortly after she arrives, Amber and her little brother Ricky, who she lovingly calls Bubba, go on a quick ride around the block. It's about 3 p.m. Amber's 9 years old and loves school. She's on the honor roll and has perfect attendance. She's an especially good kid, but she's also carefree and fun-loving, so she rides to the parking lot of an abandoned grocery store where there's a loading dock ramp she can practically fly down on her pink bicycle. She knows she's not supposed to travel this far, but it's just one block out of the way. Ricky, who's just 5 years old, is afraid they'll get in trouble. Amber assures him he can just ride straight back to the house. She'll be right behind him, she says, and watches Ricky turn back home. Nearby, 78-year-old Jim Kevel works on a car in his backyard. From his house, he has a direct line of sight to the grocery store parking lot, where he sees Amber riding up and down the ramp. Jim also sees when a black truck drives up to the loading dock. A man jumps out of the driver's side, grabs Amber off her bike, kicking and screaming, puts her in the truck through the open side door, and roars away. Jim notes that the driver pauses for a moment before leaving the parking lot, and ultimately heads toward the center of town. It's a bit strange, because he could have turned the opposite way toward the highway and gotten out of Arlington fast. Immediately, Jim knows something isn't right. He dials 911 to report what he saw. It's 3:18 p.m. When Ricky returns to his grandparents' house, he realizes Amber isn't right behind him like she said she would be. So Ricky tells his grandfather, Jimmy Whitson, that Amber went to that abandoned parking lot. Jimmy scoops Ricky up and they go to get her. But all they find is Amber's pink bicycle. Shortly after, a police officer shows up, responding to the 911 call. Amber's grandfather tells authorities who the bike belongs to, so right off the bat, they know exactly who they're looking for. Police interview Jim Kevel, the man who called 911, and is to this day the only known witness. Jim tells officials that the man who took Amber was either white or Hispanic, in his 20s or 30s, under 6 feet tall, medium build, with brown or black hair. The truck was a big black pickup, single cab, in good condition, and either from the 1980s or 90s. He's pretty sure he saw the same black truck sitting outside the adjacent laundromat about 45 minutes before the abduction. As Jimmy and Ricky drive back up to his house, Amber's mother Donna walks outside to greet them, expecting Amber to be there too. they break the news to her. Donna is a hardworking single mother. It's because of her that Amber works so hard in school. When she was a kid, Donna dropped out and had to get her high school equivalency degree later in life and take classes to get a better job. She instilled in Amber the importance of academics. When Amber was 7, Donna made the decision to leave the kid's father, Richard, because according to her, he drank and was abusive. Richard eventually re-entered the kids' lives, but Donna raised them, and she'd voluntarily gotten by without child support for a long time. When Donna learns Amber is missing, she runs down the street yelling her daughter's name. She even calls her ex Richard, who jumps into action alongside the police. Even though Arlington PD hasn't worked many cases like this, it's pretty much all hands on deck once the word of Amber's abduction spreads. Neighbors become volunteers. Pink ribbons go up on trees, cars, everywhere all over town, a sign of hope that Amber will come home safe. Amber's story makes the 6 o'clock news that night. They air footage of Amber recently caught by a local news crew. They'd begun filming Donna, Amber, and Ricky 5 months earlier for a special on single mothers on welfare. It was meant to air the following week, but the special was delayed, and the footage was later used in a documentary called After Amber. Donna says she did the project because she believed it might help others in her situation. Four days after Amber's abduction, Stuart Coker takes his dog on a late-night walk behind his apartment complex. Shortly before midnight, he sees Amber's body near a creek beyond a short fence, just 3 to 4 miles away from her grandparents' house. The following month, a task force is put together to investigate Amber's murder. They clear over 5,500 leads, but never identify a suspect. But from what they can tell, it's a rare stranger abduction. Based on Jim Kevel's witness testimony, it doesn't seem like Amber's killer stopped to talk to her or even asked her to get in the car. He just grabbed her while she screamed. So it's likely she didn't know her abductor. Investigators believe the man probably knew this area of Arlington well. The parking lot and the creek where Amber's body was found felt like random locations. That, and he turned toward the center of town. Early on, police look into every registered sex offender in the area, and Donna begins fighting for harsher sentences for first-time offenders. She even teams up with her ex Richard to get petitions signed. Together, they speak in public to drum up support. Donna also testifies before a congressional subcommittee. That October, she's present when Bill Clinton signs the Amber Hagerman Child Protection Act. The new law includes life imprisonment for a second sexual offense against a child. Now, you may already know Amber Hagerman's name. She's the namesake of the Amber Alert, the international warning system that can instantly send information to radio and TV stations about a child abduction, and today can send messages straight to your phone. Amber is also an acronym that stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response. It's a lightning-fast way to inform the public about the missing, what they look like, who might have taken them, and when. They sometimes even include a license plate number of potential suspects. What you might not know is the whole system all started with one concerned citizen. Over in the Fort Worth area, Deanna Simone couldn't stop thinking about Amber, as well as an incident she witnessed years earlier. She was in a busy shopping center when a young child went missing. Deanna watched all around her as the child's mother and other shoppers quickly spread the word. Moments later, the child was found. Deanna was struck with an idea. What if there was a way to get the word out like that for every missing child? So she called up her favorite radio station and pitched her plan, which she suggested naming after Amber Hagerman. Because in Amber's case, there was a witness who called 911 right away, but the public didn't really learn of the abduction until it hit the news about 3 hours later. In that time, investigators believe the killer could have easily found a way to disappear. Deanna thought someone must have seen a black truck driving through town in those first few minutes. But there's nothing notable about a black truck in Arlington, Texas, unless you know to look out for one. By the end of the year, Deanna helps get an early version of the Amber Alert system in Texas up and running. Other states followed suit. In 2003, Amber's mom Donna returns to the White House for the moment the PROTECT Act is signed into law. With the stroke of a pen, Amber Alerts go nationwide. But it's also incredibly important to note, Amber's story isn't over yet. In January 2021, 25 years after Amber's abduction, Arlington authorities hold a press conference. They confirm they have evidence, which they hope may provide a DNA profile of their suspect in Amber's case. The goal of the press conference is to reinvigorate enthusiasm and inspire anyone with relevant information to come forward. As of this recording, they're still receiving tips every month, and there's a consensus that Amber's case will be solved. Donna speaks at the press conference. She says she's proud of her daughter's legacy. And she should be. To date, the program has brought over 1,000 children home safe. Some of them are grown now, and at least one considers Amber their guardian angel. The Amber Alert has directly impacted countless lives for the better. And at the state level, it's paved the way for other systems, like the Silver Alert for older missing persons. In California, new legislation was passed for an Ebony Alert for Black women and children aged 12 to 25. As of this recording, it's on the cusp of being signed into law. But all this progress is also bittersweet. Donna wants people to remember Amber, not just the alert named after her. She gives what may be her last interview in the 2023 documentary, Amber, the Girl Behind the Alert. The documentary also features Deanna Simone. I highly recommend tuning in and listening to her story. It's a great reminder that anybody can come up with an idea that saves lives and changes the world. Because it shouldn't have to take another tragedy for the next brilliant idea to come around. Amber's case is still open and active. If you have any information, please call the Arlington PD tip line at 817-575-8823 or Crime Stoppers of Tarrant County at 817-469-8477. About 15 years before Amber Hagerman disappears, 6-year-old Adam Walsh and his mother, Reveille, are out running errands in Hollywood, Florida. On their list of things to do is pick up some lamps for their living room. A recent Sears advertisement had the style they want on sale. Reveille and Adam leave the house a little after 11 a.m. They drop off a tuition check at Adam's school and then head straight to the mall. Before they reach the lighting department, Reveille and Adam pass a section for toys and games. There's a group of kids gathered around the new video game display, and Adam asks if he can stay there while his mom shops. Reveille says it's okay. Adam's not the type of kid to wander off on his own, and she's not going far. She tells Adam exactly where she's headed, right over there. She'll be right back. Reveille says she's only gone for about 5 minutes total. 10 at the max. But when she arrives, Adam's not there. No one is. The group of kids huddled around the video game are all gone. Reveille searches for Adam or any of the other kids and finally finds a boy she recognizes. He's wearing a hat similar to the one Adam had on. She asks the boy if he saw Adam and where he went. She's not sure whether he speaks English, though, because he doesn't answer. He just raises a finger and points to a nearby exit. As the minutes tick by, panic sets in. Reveille races around the mall, desperately looking for her son. But no one in the mall seems to understand her concern. Everyone pretty much tells her, "Hey, he's a kid. He probably just wandered off and will turn up soon." But Reveille knows her son. She knows something's wrong. Over the next 2 hours or so, Reveille covers every inch of the mall. She has a photo in her purse where Adam's wearing the same shirt he had on that day. She shows it to everyone she runs into, and convinces an employee to make an announcement over the intercom. But all it says is,
"Adam Walsh, please come to customer service."
As if a six-year-old would know where customer service was. As if anyone listening would understand the stakes of the situation, what Adam looked like, or what to do if they spotted him. The Hollywood Police Department is located just across the street from the mall. After getting a call, a few officers casually pull into the mall and tell Revay that they'll send out an alert to authorities to be on the lookout for Adam. But they say they really only handle runaways. In fact, they suggest Adam maybe ran away or walked over a mile to their home all by himself. At some point, Adam's grandmother and father join Revay in her waking nightmare. They retrace steps, try to work with the police. As the sun sets and stores begin to close, the Walshes finally leave the mall. But they keep the car Revay drove in the parking lot unlocked in case Adam returns. They make a bed in the back seat for Adam and leave toys and books next to a note that reads, "Adam, stay in the car. Mommy and Daddy are looking for you." Later, they learn that a young, part-time security guard broke up an argument between the group of kids playing the video game that day. They split the kids up and sent them out of the store. Adam was accidentally lumped into the group. No one knew what happened to him after heading out the door. In the coming weeks, the Walshes realize just how unprepared authorities are for their son's investigation. Tips pour in as a large-scale manhunt begins, but it becomes clear that officials are basically figuring things out as they go. There's no protocol or procedures in place. At a certain point, officers begin asking John, Adam's dad, if he has any ideas on what they should try next. There's some media attention around the case at first, but nothing that big or attention-grabbing. The Miami News quotes a police officer who says, "The kid is probably lost somewhere, and we're searching the city for him. Kidnapping is not suspected." The article even gets the Walsh's home address wrong. John and Revay are left to arrange their own press interviews. They announce a $5,000 reward for Adam's return. They design posters with all the relevant information. 3 feet 6 inches tall, 45 pounds, hazel eyes, missing a front tooth. Last seen wearing green shorts, a red and white striped shirt, yellow sandals, and a beige captain's hat. They distribute tens of thousands of flyers. At the bottom, they include the message, "We are willing to negotiate ransom on any terms. Strict confidentiality. Do not fear revenge. We will not prosecute. We only want our son." The posters fly in the face of investigators' insistence that abduction isn't on the table. Missing is as far as they'll go. So the Walshes take their media campaign further and go national with the story. But Adam Walsh's fate isn't a mystery for much longer. 2 weeks after that day in the mall, a group of fishermen find something in a drainage canal near Vero Beach, 130 miles away. It may be the partial remains of a young boy, about 10 years old. Because of the distance and age difference, many assume it couldn't be Adam. But tests confirm, it is. The rest of his body is never found. And the road to solving Adam's murder is a long one. More than 2 years after his disappearance, a man named Otis Toole makes a confession from jail. He drives with police to the mall the Walshes visited that day. He shows them the bench where he found Adam, sitting outside. He talks about how Adam cried for his mother, then takes authorities to a dirt road in Jacksonville, and claims he and an accomplice, a fellow serial killer named Henry Lee Lucas, ended the six-year-old's life. Toole later sends a letter to Adam's father, John, from prison, attempting to blackmail him. Toole says he'll tell John where the rest of his son's remains are if he pays him a total sum of $50,000. Investigators find bloodstains on the carpet of Toole's car. They take samples, but can't confirm if the blood belongs to Adam. DNA technology just isn't that advanced yet. Before any direct connection can be made, officials discover some discrepancies in Toole's confession, like that his alleged accomplice, Henry Lee Lucas, was in jail at the time of Adam's abduction. And then Toole recants. Both Toole and Lucas are convicted of multiple first-degree murders each, but they're also found to have made a number of false confessions, making it difficult to separate fact from fiction. In 1994, the technology becomes available to test the carpet from Toole's car for Adam's DNA. But when investigators go to pull the samples from evidence, they're not there. They've somehow been lost or misplaced along with Toole's car, so there's nothing they can do. 2 years later, in 1996, Toole dies in prison while serving 5 life sentences. And there isn't another update in Adam's case until 2008, more than a decade later. Officials with the Hollywood Police Department in Florida announced they're closing Adam's case. No new evidence has been brought to light, but after reviewing the old files, investigators are convinced Otis Toole was responsible. They believe they had enough to charge Toole before he died. They say they didn't close the case earlier, partly because of the mistakes they made in the past. A representative said, quote, "The Hollywood Police Department ended up in a situation where for years we took a defensive posture on this case, instead of focusing on Otis Toole." It's a huge day for Adam's family. At a press conference, John Walsh makes a statement. "Today is a reaffirmation of the fact that he didn't die in vain. For all other victims who haven't gotten justice, I say one thing. Don't give up hope." John and Reve have waited a long time for this moment, and I may get a little emotional, so stay with me. They talk about how the not knowing was torture, but they make it clear. The end of Adam's investigation is not about closure. It's about justice. Up until that moment, the Walsh's journey to justice had been a long one. Back in 1981, the same month Adam disappeared, Reve and John Walsh raised a $100,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in their son's case. They held an empty casket funeral for Adam and launched the Adam Walsh Outreach Center for Missing Children in his honor. Before the year was over, they testified before Congress, lobbying on behalf of the Missing Children Act, which required the FBI to keep a national database for missing children to assist law enforcement agencies across the country. The act passed the following year, when President Ronald Reagan signed it into law, and its powers were expanded soon after with the passing of the Missing Children's Assistance Act. In June 1984, they launched the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and held its opening ceremony. Now, you've heard me talk about NCMEC countless times on this show. They were actually the only organization to help with my sister Alyssa's missing person case when she first went missing. The only organization that treated her case with urgency. Since then, I've seen them help countless other families in similar situations. I cannot recommend their organization enough. They truly get it, and they truly care. And their website lists some incredible stats. Their national toll-free hotline, 1-800-THE-LOST, has apparently received more than 5 million calls. They've helped circulate billions of missing person photos and assisted law enforcement in the recovery of more than 376,000 missing children. And they say that's thanks to, quote, "constantly increasing and improving public awareness, training, laws, and technology." In addition to founding NCMEC, you might know John Walsh as the host of America's Most Wanted, which ran for more than 25 years, with millions of viewers tuning in weekly. Through the show, John says he's helped catch more than 1,000 murderers, fugitives, and wanted criminals. And he did it his way. In an essay for Newsweek, he wrote, quote, "I was approached about the show, but I had conditions for taking part. I wanted to run the hotline and staff it with real people, not cops. I refused to show the faces of any child victims on TV. There would be no salaciousness, and I wanted to choose the cases and work directly with the marshals and FBI. I would pass tips to the cops. In fact, I picked the very first case we covered on AMW, David James Roberts. The child killer was on the FBI's most wanted list. No one had any idea where he was. After the show aired his case on February 7th, 1988, he was caught within days. As many of you know, John Walsh is a personal hero of mine and gave me the confidence to begin telling Alyssa's story in my own words. He inspired and continues to inspire my mission in true crime, which is to create advocacy-based content that minimizes harm and focuses on how this incredible following true crime has amassed can help these cases. I truly believe that the future of true crime will incorporate the voices of so many more families, survivors, and loved ones of victims who can offer a more in-depth and personal understanding of these cases and the best ways to help them. In his book, Tears of Rage, John Walsh references the following verse in a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. I sing to him that rests below, and since the grasses round me wave, I take the grasses of the grave and make them pipes whereon to blow. It goes hand in hand with the mantra the Walshes have adopted on Adam's behalf. If his song is to continue, we must do the singing. It reminds me of a sentiment I shared at the end of our very first episode. If we keep talking about the missing, they won't have to leave us twice. But today I'll add, if we keep fighting for them, a more just world can follow. Thank you for listening. This is our last episode, so I wanted to say thank you again from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for listening, and thank you for believing in me. Thank you for believing that true crime can be so much more than just entertainment. I and this show wouldn't be here without each and every one of you out there listening and believing in a new way of doing true crime. Thank you. I love you, and I'll talk to you soon. In the time it took you to finish this episode, 40 people disappeared in the United States alone. Among the many sources we used for this episode, we found the books The Father's Story by Christian K. Ross, Tears of Rage by John Walsh, and the documentaries Amber, The Girl Behind the Alert, and After Amber, extremely helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify podcasts for free on Spotify. This episode was written and edited by Maggie Admire, Mickey Taylor, and Connor Sampson. Researched by Brian Petrus, Mickey Taylor, and Chelsea Wood. Fact-checked by Lori Siegel. And produced and sound designed by Alex Button. Our head of programming is Julian Boireau. Our head of production is Nick Johnson. And Spencer Howard is our post-production supervisor. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.